Welcome to Text Messages. These recommendations for teen readers are produced by ReadWriteThink.org, a partnership between the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association. This is episode 59 of Text Messages, reporting on Teen Book Awards. I'm your host, Jennifer Bueller. Though it's been about a month since the announcement of the American Library Association Youth Media Awards at the end of January, I'm excited to bring you my fifth annual report on the year's most celebrated books for teens. For people who love young adult literature, January really is the best time of the year, mainly because it's a time when the internet absolutely buzzes with discussion of books. This year I made daily visits to the School Library Journal website, where I avidly followed posts on two blogs, Heavy Metal, a Mock Newbery blog, and Someday My Prince Will Come, a blog dedicated to the Michael L. Prince Award for Excellence in Young Adult Literature. Reading those blogs reminds me what a social experience reading can be, how we construct our ideas of what makes a good book in the company of others, and how different people discover entirely different things in the same text. Book awards bring about those conversations, and in the process, they challenge us to become sharper and more self-aware as readers. This year, when the ALA Youth Media Awards press conference rolled around, I was camped out at my local library, watching the live webcast on my laptop and following the reaction on Twitter. Once the webcast ended, I went to the teen room to grab copies of winning titles I didn't already own. Then the push began to work my way through all those books. Predictably, I'm not yet finished, but I've loved plunging deeply into titles I'd heard so much about in the run-up to the award announcements, and reading titles I might never have discovered if they hadn't shown up on award lists. That's what I find so inspiring and helpful about Teen Book Awards, and that's why I return to this topic every year. Book awards honor the literary and artistic achievements of individual authors, but collectively, they call our attention to a huge variety of quality books for teens. When you consider that there are awards for excellence in most every literary genre, for depictions of the experiences of diverse teens, and for books that combine literary excellence and teen appeal, you start to see how book awards can help you build a reading list that will lead you through a truly impressive range of books. Books on very different topics, books for very different readers. In this episode, I'll report on an assortment of the year's biggest award-winning books. A few of these books have been featured on past episodes of Text Messages. Others are brand new to me and possibly to you. You'll hear about stories of espionage, climate change, and dragons, middle school theater, political revolutions, coping with cancer, and more. Because of their variety and complexity, I can assure you that teens and adults alike will find something to love here. Some titles are serious, some will make you laugh out loud. None is right for every reader, but each is right for someone. Looking back on this year's Youth Media Awards Day, there were two books that stood out among the host of titles that were honored. These are books I call blockbuster winners because they were recognized by award committees across multiple categories. You've actually heard about both of them on past episodes of Text Messages. The first is Bomb, The Race to Build and Steal the World's Most Dangerous Weapon by Steve Sheinkin, which I featured last November in the show on science books for teens. Bomb was by far the most celebrated nonfiction book of the year, in large part due to its compelling narrative style. One of the things award lists can help us see is Bomb's accessibility for readers of different ages. It won the Robert F. Seibert Award for Best Informational Book for Children and the YALSA Excellence in Nonfiction Award, which is given to books for teens. Award lists also show us Baum's general literary excellence, in that it was named a finalist for the National Book Award, as well as a Newbery Honor Book. One other award that Baum won highlights the book's combination of literary merit and teen appeal, and that's the Sibbles Award for Middle Grade and Young Adult Nonfiction. The Sibbles Awards are given by the book blogging community. If you're looking for an all-around excellent nonfiction title for teenagers, BOM may be the book for you. The other book that was celebrated repeatedly on Youth Media Awards Day is Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe by Benjamin Alire Sines. I told you about this book last July in a show on new and noteworthy books for teens, but I could have just as easily featured it in the show on smart romance. What I didn't know before I read the book is that what begins as the story of two boys' friendship ultimately becomes the story of their love for one another. Here's another book whose excellence cuts across categories. Aristotle and Dante won the Stonewall Award for Excellence in Gay and Lesbian Literature for Teens, the Pura Belpre Award for Outstanding Latino Literature for Teens, and a Prince Honor Award for General Literary Excellence in Young Adult Literature. Aristotle and Dante also went on to be named a top 10 best fiction book for young adults. It's wonderful to see this gentle book receive such recognition. Aristotle and Dante is a lyrical coming-of-age story that dignifies the experience of gay teens. Two more nonfiction titles were honored on multiple award lists this year. One I've read, but the other is still sitting in the stack of books right here beside me. What's fascinating about these two books is that they received almost identical award recognition, and like Bomb, they potentially appeal to both older and younger readers. Moonbird, A Year on the Wind with the Great Survivor B95 by Philip Hose, is a book I told you about last fall in the show on science books for teens. But there's also Titanic, Voices from the Disaster by Deborah Hopkinson. Each of these books was named a Robert F. Seibert Honor Book, a finalist for the YALSA Excellence in Nonfiction Award, and a finalist for the Sibyls Award for Middle Grade and Young Adult Nonfiction. I want to turn now to a second crop of award winners, books that I've not previously featured on text messages, but ones that rose to the top of my reading pile over the past month because of the praise they've earned from different award committees. The first is Codename Verity, a work of historical fiction by Elizabeth Wien. I had heard this book bandied about as a Prince contender since early last fall. Sure enough, in January, Codename Verity was named a Prince Honor Book. It had already been chosen as an honor book for the Boston Globe Horn Book Award and listed as a finalist for the Sibyls Award in YA Fiction. Codename Verity went on to be named a top 10 best fiction book for young adults, and it made the Amelia Bloomer list of outstanding feminist books for teens. Next to Bomb, Codename Verity is the most decorated YA book of the past year. In fact, when I was in the midst of working on this podcast, Verity was named a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. I'm an extremely motivated reader of YA award winners, so listeners may be interested to know that it took me several tries before I got caught up in the story of Codename Verity. I think one reason may be because this book is many different things at once. On the one hand, it's a World War II thriller where the two main characters are girls. One is a pilot and one is a spy. Together they run air missions into Nazi-occupied France, delivering supplies and gathering intelligence for the Allied forces. At its core, the book is the story of their friendship. At the same time, it's an intense work of historical research with tons of information about planes, airfields, and wireless code. Some of those layers were difficult for me, since I know so little about those things. But where this book gets good, where it grips its readers and doesn't let go, is in its narrative structure. Main character Queenie, codenamed Verity, is the spy. When the story begins, she's been captured by the Nazis and is being held as a prisoner of war. Her captors have tortured her, and in order to stop the torture, she's agreed to write out a confession. Queenie's account is raw and immediate. Her words are filled with voice and emotion. Day after day, she reaches back in time and discloses the details of her work with Maddie, the pilot, their missions, but also the origins of their friendship. Every so often, Queenie's comments about her present situation yank us out of the narrative about Maddie. Queenie despises herself for cooperating with the enemy, but the Nazis keep her ankles tied to a chair. They burn her and prick her with pins. They threaten to destroy her skin with carbolic acid. So we read to learn the backstory about Maddie, especially because we pick up hints that something awful has happened to her. But at the same time, we read in fear for Queenie's life. Will the Nazis kill her after they get all they can from her confession? Will they execute her or send her to a concentration camp to be the subject of gruesome medical experiments? And then, all of a sudden, we get to part two of this novel, and everything changes. In her acceptance speech at the Boston Globe Horn Book Awards, Elizabeth Wien described the power of historical fiction as its ability to show how the present and the past are inextricably linked. Good historical fiction, she said, brings the past into the present and makes it relevant. In our post-9/11 era, we are not far removed from stories about the use of torture to bring about confession. This book reminds us that the truth is elusive and that a person's will can be tested in unimaginable ways. But it also reminds us that the bonds of friendship are strong and individuals can remain true to each other even in the most horrible circumstances. Codename Verity is a moving and remarkable page-turner and an inspiring account of friendship. The next book I want to tell you about is the most distinguished fantasy title of the past year, and that's Serafina, a novel by first-time YA author Rachel Hartman. Serafina won the William C. Morris Award for a debut work of young adult fiction and the Sybils Award for high school fantasy and science fiction. It was also named a top 10 best fiction book for young adults and an older notable book for children. More than other award winners, Serafina is a book that readers seem to fall in love with. One of the bloggers on Someday My Prince Will Come talked about the difference between head books and heart books. There are books that you know are brilliant and thus award-worthy. Those are head books. But there are books you simply love and wish to see recognized with award honors. Those are heart books. For many readers, Serafina was a heart book. The writing in Serafina is beautiful, but I think readers' love for this book is a response to its themes. Main character Serafina lives her life in hiding. She's the product of a love affair between a human father and a dragon mother. Because her mixed-race heritage makes her an abomination in the eyes of society, Serafina disguises the dragon part of herself and passes as human. She works as a musician in the royal court, but lives in fear that her true identity will someday be found out. Meanwhile, the uneasy truce between dragons and humans is being tested when a member of the royal family is found beheaded. Those around Serafina are sure the murder was done by a dragon, so much of the talk she hears about her own kind is hateful and venomous. For me, Serafina is a book about the crippling pain of self-hatred. Serafina truly thinks of herself as a monster. Her self-loathing becomes acute when she falls in love with the prince of the royal court, who himself is already engaged. But even Serafina's friendship with the prince is painful, because she's constantly forced to hide who she really is. Lying wasn't something I did, as something I was, she says. I was a scaly fiend that could never change. There are many painful moments like this in Serafina, and anyone who's ever felt hated or despised will find it hard not to be moved by them. But that's not all Serafina has to offer. Yes, this book is a fantasy romance, but it's also a mystery. The plot is enriched by the rumblings of a political coup, secret identities, and the threat of impending war. Because its handling of romance is tasteful and gentle, Serafina can easily be read by younger teens. But its themes will speak most powerfully to readers who have lived enough years to empathize with Serafina's pain and understand her need for redemption. If Codename Verity and Serafina are both award-winning books that take readers into unfamiliar worlds, Endangered, a novel by Elliot Schreifer, does so as well, only here the setting is the present, and the country is the Congo, and political revolution is not a rumbling threat, but a full-blown reality. American teenager Sophie has traveled to the Congo to spend the summer with her mother, a conservationist who works at a sanctuary for endangered bonobo monkeys. Without intending to, Sophie becomes entangled in this world when she impulsively buys an abused bonobo from a beggar at a roadblock in the streets of Kinshasa. The animal is covered with scabs and sores. It's missing fingers. It's sick and starving. And it's just a baby. Sophie names the baby Otto, and she makes it her mission to nurse him back to health. But the world of the Congo is more complicated than Sophie knows. Her impulsive act brings the beggar, who's actually an animal trafficker, to the sanctuary with more baby bonobos to sell. Violence, bribes, poverty, and starvation. Readers quickly learn these are everyday facts of life in the Congo. As Sophie's attachment to Otto grows, the political situation in the Congo deteriorates. Riots in the streets, lootings, mass killings with machetes. Finally, all U.S. citizens are ordered to evacuate. But when the UN van arrives for her, Sophie refuses to get in. She can't bear to leave Otto behind. She flees from the UN peacekeepers and locks herself behind the gates of the Bonobo Sanctuary. Within hours, the rebels have descended on her mother's clinic, slaughtering all those who've stayed behind. Sophie's task, then, with Otto, turns to surviving. Endangered is a wonderfully rich book, layered with information about Congolese history and the social and emotional worlds of the Bonobo. An author's note and a Q&A in the back of the book allow readers to learn about the research Schrieffer did and the real-world context for the story he created. I love reading that kind of back matter because it provides everyday readers with points of entry into the issues the book explores. The last two questions in the book ask, what do Congo and its bonobos need now? And what can someone sitting in relative luxury do to help? I can't think of a better way to raise readers' consciousness than by drawing them into a powerful story like Endangered and then inviting them to act. Award committee members must have been similarly moved by the richness and substance of this book. Endangered was honored for literary excellence several times over when it was named a National Book Award finalist, a best fiction book for young adults, and a finalist for the Sibbles Award in YA fiction. Also, in a nod to Sophie, the book's strong girl protagonist, Endangered was chosen for this year's Amelia Bloomer list. Another book that draws readers into an unfamiliar world is this year's Prince Award winner, In Darkness, by Nick Lake. Unlike the other books featured in this episode, In Darkness is not one of those blockbuster award winners. By my count, it was only recognized by two committees. It won the Prince, and it was named a best fiction book for young adults. But more than any other book in this episode, In Darkness is the novel that had me copying down powerful lines as I read it. I wasn't expecting a book about a Haitian teenager and Haitian history to speak to my reality here in St. Louis, Missouri, but it did, and it does. The premise is this. A poor Haitian teenager, a violent gang member, is trapped beneath the rubble of the 2010 earthquake. While lying in the darkness, this gang member, Shorty, reflects on his life. Meanwhile, he's visited by the ghost of Toussaint L'Ouverture, a figure from Haitian history who led a slave rebellion in the 1700s. Their two narratives unfold in parallel storylines shaped by poverty, suffering, and betrayal. I enjoyed reading the first-person account of Toussaint's coming to consciousness and his role in leading the Haitian people to revolt. But Toussaint's account became powerful when it served as a mirror and a foil to Shorty's. Reading the two accounts side by side challenges readers to ask how lives born of suffering could turn out so different. The book does offer an answer. Shorty tells readers at one point, "When you keep hurting someone, you do one of three things. Either you fill them up with hate, and they destroy everything around them. Or you fill them up with sadness, and they destroy themselves. Or you fill them up with justice, and they try to destroy everything that's bad and cruel in the world." Now that I've gotten to know teens in St. Louis whose own lives are shaped by poverty and violence, I can't help but read Shorty's story against theirs. Lying trapped in darkness beneath the rubble of the earthquake, Shorty thinks about how his life came to be, and he wonders if another life is possible. Using poetic language and touches of magical realism, In Darkness humanizes Shorty by showing the logic behind his crimes and the existential quality of his suffering. This is a book that doesn't offer any easy answers, not about gangs, poverty, or the problems in Haiti. But it does ask readers profound questions about the suffering of people and nations, and what it will take to heal them. Two final books for this episode are lighter than the others you've heard about, but they too have been celebrated by multiple award committees and deserve mention on the show. The first is a graphic novel called Drama by Raina Telgemeier. You might remember Raina's name if you read her graphic novel memoir, Smile, which also racked up a long list of book awards. Like Smile, Drama was named a top 10 great graphic novel for teens, a notable book for children, and a finalist for the Sybils Award for middle grade graphic novels. Unlike Smile, Drama was also named a Stonewall Honor Book. The story in Drama is pretty straightforward. Main character Callie loves theater, but she's not a very talented performer. She finds her home in the set crew, and it turns out that working backstage puts her in a perfect position to witness plenty of real-life middle school drama unfolding around her. Some of Callie's friends are gay and others are straight, but typical of middle school, they all spend excessive amounts of time obsessing about their romantic crushes. Meanwhile, the awkwardness of middle school is layered in here for full effect. We see characters struggling to learn how to slow dance, agonizing over whether to send a confessional text message, and fighting over the same boy. Because these conflicts are familiar and short-lived, there's a warm and youthful feel to this book. Problems are solved, and no one gets badly hurt. The structure of Drama is a series of acts, just like a play. It even includes an intermission. By the end, I found myself thinking of Shakespearean comedies, because so much of the plot tension was rooted in unrequited love, quarrels and misunderstandings, and questions of who would end up with whom in the end. For younger teens who want a believable school story that treats gay kids like regular people, Drama would make a great choice. The last book I want to tell you about rose to the top of my reading pile just a couple of days ago after I compiled a list of books that were named both best fiction books for young adults and quick picks for reluctant young adult readers. I always look forward to seeing this list of books deemed both quality literature and appealing reading for teens who don't typically like to read. This year, 9 books made the cut. As in the past, you can see the complete list on the handout that accompanies this episode. The book that caught my attention was Jesse Adams' debut novel, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. I picked this one out of the stack because not only was it a top 10 best fiction book and a quick pick, it also won the Sybils Award for YA fiction. People on the Sybils site were raving about it, so I decided to give it a try. To sum it up, Me and Earl is about a pathologically awkward kid named Glenn who is guilt-tripped by his mom into spending time with a girl named Rachel who he used to know when they were kids and who's now dying of cancer. Earl is Glenn's best friend, angry, worldly, crude, and brilliant. Since age 11, the boys have been watching art films and making awful home movies. Together, they and their movies get mixed up with Rachel. And for some reason, Glenn is now writing a book about it. But he'll be the first to tell you that his book is terrible, as are his films. What he can do, if not write books or produce decent movies, is make people laugh. Despite the morbid storyline, I have to tell you, I began laughing just a couple pages into this book, and I continued to laugh on and off until the last page. I haven't laughed so hard at a book in years. What you get here is boy humor through and through. Be advised that certain parts, particularly having to do with girls, breasts, and sex, are extremely profane. But the humor is so clever and smart, you can't help but laugh. And despite all the bad words, you can't help but love the story. That's because beneath all the jokes about the social hierarchies of high school and perpetual awkwardness with the opposite sex and annoying moms, you find 3 complex characters who are trying to figure out how to deal with terminal illness. Their actions aren't always admirable, and Greg admits it, but that's what makes him so appealing as a narrator and a character. He's trying to figure things out. Sometimes he does a very bad job of it, but he keeps trying. I hope you will read these books and recommend them to the teens in your life. Each title should be available at your local library or bookstore. Remember that no book is right for every reader, so preview books for appropriate reading level and content before passing them on to your teen. Next month, I'll be back to bring you a conversation with legendary young adult author Chris Crutcher. We'll talk about his newest novel, Period 8, which will be published in March, and the challenges of trying to write honest books for teenagers. Until next time, I'm Jennifer Bueller. More episodes of Text Messages are available at www.readwritethink.org/textmessages. You can listen to our elementary book podcast, Chatting About Books, at www.readwritethink.org/chattingaboutbooks. Text Messages is supported by the Verizon Foundation through thinkfinity.org and produced monthly by the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association. Music in this podcast is courtesy of Scott Andrew. Thanks for listening and look forward to more text messages soon.